Good morning. Welcome to Corporate Conversations. I'm Dawn Ely with our producer, Lee Cantor.
Hey, how are you doing today, Dawn?
Good morning. I'm great, thanks, Lee. How are you?
Big show. I'm excited.
Yeah. Today's show is on distressed companies, recognizing them, and what can work to get out of distress. And we have three fabulous guests who have great experience in this area. Greg Charleston, CPA and Senior Managing Director of Conway McKenzie and a certified turnaround professional. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Dawn.
Thank you. And Jonathan Friedberg, President of Aberdeen Funding. Good morning, Jonathan.
Morning, Dawn.
And Betty Reed, CPA and Certified Management Accountant and Principal of Abraxas Business Services. Good morning, Betty.
Good morning.
It's fabulous to have you all here. I appreciate you being here. Our show today is sponsored by Palladium Chief Legal Officers. Palladium Chief Legal Officers provides highly experienced part-time in-house CLOs to companies at flat rates for internal, operational, and strategic legal expertise as part of a management team, but without having to pay for an expensive full-time employee. Proactive and strategic legal work in a business context is the best way to avoid problems. It's not just about protecting your company, but it's about seeing the possibilities, not just the liabilities. You can find out more about our sponsor at www.palladiumclos.com. All right. Well, let's get started. As we are talking about distressed companies, the research is a little bit out there. There's plenty of collateral on that. But a lot of companies, it seems, don't even know that they're in a distressed situation. There is a publication out there called the Distressed Company Alert that, for public companies, notifies the world of companies in distress based on several factors. Those include defaults, missed payments on a debt obligation, a covenant violation of such a debt agreement, audit concern, even just a downgrading of a company's rating to only a B level is sometimes an alert that it's in a distressed situation, and various other types of subjective criteria that have costs associated with it as well. But a lot of people like to look at the cash flow test or the balance sheet test that just talks about, are they able to pay their debts and are their assets lower than their liabilities? But in determining whether or not a company is going to be successful in trying to get out of a distressed situation, there seems to be a lot of people who think there are varying factors as to whether or not a company is going to be successful. One of them is obviously the management commitment to a turnaround situation. A lot of other things that have been mentioned include what are the value of the assets, efficiency-oriented strategies, company size. In fact, there is some information out there that says that a smaller company is maybe more likely to be successful than a large company in turnaround just simply because they're more nimble and may be able to gain more consistent buy-in. But that's all statistics and theory and general information. What we want to find out from our very experienced guests here is, what is reality? What is happening in the marketplace currently right now? And so I want to go to start with Betty. Betty Reed, a principal of Abraxas Business Services, is going to see a lot of companies probably before they even realize they're in a distressed situation. All they know is they either want to buy or they want to sell. And Betty, as principal of Abraxas Business Services, joined Abraxas in 2006, and it is an Atlanta-based business brokerage firm serving small southeastern-based privately held companies in the manufacturing, distribution, healthcare, and service industries. And Ms. Reed works specifically mostly with the service, logistics, and healthcare companies. So, Betty, tell me a little bit about your experience. What do you see companies in a distressed situation when they come seeking your services?
The answer is yes, even though I have to say that Abraxas does not normally seek out distressed companies. And I think a very good example are two companies that we began working with right before the recession hit. One was a manufacturing company, the other a service company that was a franchise or a food service delivery. neither one of these companies could be defined as a distressed company when we started working with them. But given that when the recession hit and it was an ongoing recession, they both became distressed companies. What did they have in common? What did we see? What made them successful? And I will tell you that the service company is no longer in business. The manufacturing company is still going. Not out of the woods yet, but it is still hanging on, and there are specific reasons why. One of the things I have to say is that you mentioned some of the research and some of the statistics about what makes successful turnarounds. One of the primary ones outside of cash flow, and I think we'll all talk about how important cash flow is here, is not being in denial. We specifically work with smaller companies, and you have to imagine that a lot of the owners of these companies are also founders, and there's a lot of emotion that is part of the process. Getting companies to realize that they're in trouble is not as easy as you would think it would be. In fact, if you look at the similarities and the differences between the two companies that we were working with, why one has already disappeared and one continues to fight, you'd have to look at some of the items that make distressed companies viable for recovery, I guess is the best way to put it. Look at what caused each one of them to get into trouble in the first place. Let's talk about them on a comparative basis. Both of the manufacturer and the franchisor, were they over-leveraged? Yes. Why? Well, the manufacturer had added debt to acquire manufacturing and warehouse facilities. The franchisor was a fairly new business. They had started in what a lot of people would say was a fad section of the food industry, had expanded very rapidly. So there was not a lot of business experience with the owners, which were also the founders and also operated the business. Cash reserves. Did the manufacturer have cash reserves? The answer is yes. When things turned down, he had enough cash. He had the relationships with his bankers. He talked to his bankers early, so he was able to buy time. The franchisor, no. They did not have cash reserves. They were a fairly young company. They were in denial, did not want to talk with the bankers, would not take advice. We introduced them to a turnaround specialist firm because we could see it was going to take that to really step in and work with the bankers and come up with a business plan that could potentially make them viable or at least get money out of the company. They would not follow up. They would not listen. So you have two things against them already. They would not realize that they were in trouble. They also were not willing to take quick action. And when you are in trouble, quick action and talking to your financiers, whether it's banks, whether it's your equity holders, are one of the most important things you can do. Everybody on the team needs to be on the same page. Time is of the essence, and the more time that passes when you're troubled without a solution, without moving forward, the more likely you're not going to make it. That's been our experience.
Betty, did you have the obligation to try to convince the factory of their distressed situation, or did they already come to you sort of having to already known that they're in trouble?
I would say that it was our, I won't say it's our responsibility, but when we are brought on by a client, they get our full capabilities, brain power, etc. Our goal is to have a successful sale or buy. But when you see them in trouble, you know this is going to affect the ability for the company, one, to even be sold in the marketplace. It's going to really negatively impact on the price that they will be able to garner in the marketplace. And if it doesn't make sense to sell the company, then they have to take it off the market, relook at a plan to how to get it back to health before they can take it to the market. And this doesn't take place in a vacuum. There are a lot of sophisticated buyers out there that look at distressed companies. And when you're selling a company, and in each case, I think we talked about everybody in the industry. And to be fair, these two companies were operating in an industry, both of which got just absolutely negatively impacted with the recession. So it wasn't just that management made bad mistakes. The recession was working against them. One in the food service industry, and we know people stopped eating out. Unless you were McDonald's or some of the others, you did not do well in this environment. The manufacturing company, his primary, and he had some fabulous clients, but those clients were primarily in the retail business. when they stopped expanding, when they stopped adding stores, when they started cutting back, it really immediately impacted the sales volume, which flows down to the bottom line in cash flow. Excuse me. So it's not a vacuum where you're in trouble. You must tell them what you find in the marketplace. And when you talk to potential buyers, such as private equity groups, they're very attuned to what's happening in that particular industry, sometimes even with that particular company. So you don't operate in a vacuum when you're in trouble.
What is the most effective way to make a business owner who is emotionally based and connected to the business and just refuses to go down? What is the most effective way you found to sort of bring them to reality to say, here's what this really looks like and here's the situation you're really in that suddenly, you know, creates light bulbs in their head that says, wow, okay, I really do need to listen to you and I acknowledge that I'm in a bad situation?
Information. We bring in professionals if we feel like it's viable, just as with the food service company, we brought in someone that specialized in turnaround because they could say, here's what we see. Here's what we've seen in the past. Here's where you're headed. Here's what you can do if you operate now. The other information flow is coming back because both of these were still trying to be sold and wanted to be sold at the time. You are gathering constant feedback and information from a much broader market. You're talking to strategic buyers. You're talking to private equity groups that are looking at these companies, and they are giving you information that you pass along to the sellers of these companies. So they're getting from multiple sources in multiple directions, here's how we, the market, really see your company.
You know, you mentioned that the price of a distressed company can really be important, not only the price of gaining credit, but the price of a purchase price that can be deflated based on a distressed situation. There's a lot of information out there that says the buyers, private equity, hedge funds, whomever, are interested in buying distressed companies because while it is high risk, it's also high reward. So what are you seeing from the buyers who are looking for distressed companies to try to get a deal? And do these buyers really want a turnaround situation going on in these distressed companies so as to increase the value of the purchase price?
What most of the buyers that we see, and we remember work with smaller companies in the distressed area, are looking simply for assets. So if you know what you're doing, you can buy a distressed company, but it's usually the assets. It may not be the business is an ongoing business. It may be simply that it buys them a certain asset category, maybe a product, maybe something that puts them into a different market, but they will not get the value for that company, this being the seller for a going concern company, and that's a big part of the value for a smaller company. So I would not advise someone that's not fairly business savvy to buy a distressed company, but if you know what you're doing, if you have a plan and there's a fit for what you already have potentially, it could be a turnaround situation. In fact, in talking to a lot of potential buyers with the two examples I gave you, I talked to one fund in St. Louis that specializes in distressed assets, and his comment to me was, Betty, why would I pay X for this company now? We don't see this industry turning around for 2 to 3 years. In 6 months, I can walk in and buy it for half X. So very astute buyers out there.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a lot of buyers right now in this market looking for that?
We are seeing a lot of buyers, but not necessarily looking for distressed companies. Unless you are a very savvy business person, I would say stay away from distressed companies. For one thing, who's going to lend you money? Lenders want someone that know what they're doing, that's got experience with a distressed company, that knows what to ask for. And to be quite honest, it's going to look under every rock because a distressed company can't bite you if you're not very careful with the due diligence and getting financing. If you're not someone that is going to be able to get financing, how are you even going to acquire the company? Mm-hmm. So it's not as simple as it looks. Are people interested? Yes, because they read the articles you do and they say, oh, I can buy this for X and then turn around and sell it for XYZ. But if that was true in every case, we'd all be wealthy, as you know.
If you were to give advice to a seller that is interested in looking for a distressed company purchase, what kinds of key questions would you suggest that they look for and that you would want to get from the buyer situation?
The first question you have to ask is how and why did you get in this distress situation? What's going on? Is it the industry? Is it management? Did you lose a key employee, a key customer? Do banks or financing vehicles not want to be involved in this industry or this product? So those are the first two key questions. Are there hidden liabilities? Did liabilities cause you to go out of business? And you can look at, I think someone mentioned GM when we were chatting earlier, the HR liabilities killing a lot of companies. Nobody wants to take those on. And there are other liabilities out there that you really need to be aware of before you take on a company. So I would think those are at least the three or four primary questions. And then you have to understand, is it a sustainable company? Is it viable going forward?
Mm-hmm. Okay. From your perspective, what have you seen as the primary cause of companies getting themselves into a distressed situation?
In the smaller market that we work with, I would say it's almost always a cash flow issue. And I don't know how to stress it enough because we don't want to preach to people, but cash flow is something that is absolutely critical when you're starting a small company to make sure you have a handle on. And it's not just from having cash in the bank. What are your banking relationships? I have found in so many cases that a lot of small companies, like in the market that we deal with, have one banker they've worked for or worked with for years. They have trusted them, could have gone in the past for anything they needed, didn't bother to build other relationships. And when the recession hit and banks were in trouble and everybody was pulling in their lending ability, they were left high and dry. So make as many banking relationships as possible. I think that is, you can't have, when you're a small company, too many avenues because they just don't have the avenues in general that larger companies have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're actually going to talk a little bit about the financing options later on in the show with Mr. Freeberg. So that's going to be a great addition to that. But that has been a really important issue in this marketplace, whether the cash flow has been because of mismanagement or bad investments or the marketplace and customer lowering of the number of customers purchasing, et cetera, et cetera. I know a lot of clients or a lot of companies have experienced that problem. Everybody's been cutting back. Tell us a little bit more about your company, Betty, and what your company specializes in, what kinds of clients are great clients for you, and how you can best support and serve your client base.
We intentionally focused, when Abraxas was formed, on companies in the, I guess you would call it almost the micro, middle market arena, anywhere from 5 to 30 million in revenue. It's a very underserved market. It's right under where most of the niche investment banks want to be, and it's above what's referred to as Main Street brokers. We focus on manufacturing services, which Georgia has a tremendous amount of service companies, logistics, healthcare, and distribution, and you can almost lump distribution and logistics in together. It's sort of moving in that direction. But our specialty is working with first-time buyers and first-time sellers. And a lot of small companies, it will be the only time they have a sale. And the reason being, it takes a tremendous amount of hand-holding, not because these are not intelligent people you're working with, but they're not used to this process. They've maybe never worked with someone like us before, never worked with consultants. So there's a lot of education to the process, and it's scary. When you're selling your baby, as a lot of these companies are for the founders and the owners, you really want to know what's going on. And there's cold feet, as you can imagine. So it is an education. It's time-consuming, but it's very worthwhile because there's nothing, no greater feeling, I guess, than a successful buy or a successful sale when you try and get everybody to the closing table, which is not as easy as it sounds, but it's incredibly rewarding.
Wonderful. I'd like to at this time ask our other guests and Lee if anybody has a question of Betty before we move on.
Betty, this is Greg Charleston. I was just thinking your experience is very similar to mine, and what I wonder from your perspective is when a company comes to you that is in distress and they may not be totally aware of their situation and they want to sell, and the dynamics because of their cash flow situation and earnings situation may not be ideal for them to sell. How do you approach that with them to kind of bring them down to earth, so to speak?
head on. And I say that because it's probably the hardest, but the first conversation you have with these individuals is what can you expect in the marketplace? Because that expectation sets the tone for the relationship and the whole entire process. So we're very honest with these people, and we've got the market data to back it up. But you know what I have found on many occasions? Once you go through that, and if it's really, really a distressed company, regardless of the example I gave earlier, which I've never seen anybody that deep in denial, they have in the back of their mind an idea that the company may be in trouble. So it's once you get past that and they feel like you're being totally honest with them, I think it's an easier process. But I don't know any other way to do it than just information and head on, because like I said, it taints and colors the entire relationship.
Very good.
I have a question of Betty, if mm-hmm. I may. This is Jonathan. As part of your functions in dealing with these companies that you are trying to buy or sell, do you perform any additional functions other than an analysis, for example, where you can clearly identify that there is a cash flow problem? Do you help the companies find resources that would solve the issues that may preclude them from being easily sellable at that time?
The answer is yes. If they need funding, we keep a large itinerary of potential funders that we've gotten to know that we trust, whether they're in the factoring business, whether they're bankers, whether they're some sort of lender. We have friends in the turnaround business. We have consultants. So the answer is yes. We never just walk away from a company. There's always some advice or some sort of connection that we can leave with them, and we do.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you, Betty. And how can we reach you and get your services? Do you have a website and a phone number?
We have a wonderful website that we are constantly updating. It is www.abraxas.biz. Phone number 770-689-7704. We are out and about. I speak at, as other of our members do, at Speak and write many articles. So we're probably pretty easily found, but the website will get you there.
Wonderful. Well, now I'd like to move to our turnaround professional, who you probably have a tendency to bring in on more than several occasions, who can help us understand a little bit more what he does and what he finds when he does get in after you've recognized such a turnaround need. Greg Charleston is Senior Managing Director of Conway McKenzie and leads the firm's Atlanta practice. He draws more than 19 years of experience in turnaround consulting, financial crisis management, mergers and acquisitions, and business valuation. Greg himself is a certified turnaround professional and CPA and chartered financial analyst. And he has been vice president of finance with major publishing firms and with a major accounting firm as well. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be here.
Well, you've heard Betty's conversation about trying to make business owners come to a realization that they need a turnaround professional. In your experience, what are you finding when you go into companies in terms of what are some of the major needs or issues that require turnaround, and what kind of situation do you find yourself in?
Well, it was interesting listening to Betty talk about it because she almost sounds like a turnaround consultant. I mean, I could really it really resonated with me, her experience, especially with small middle market companies and the emotion and, you know, the denial that can sometimes come with a difficult situation. I'll give an example of a case that I worked on just so the listeners can get an idea for, you know, what we do and what it's like. But I'll preface that by saying that each situation can be very, very different. So a lot of what I do is simple problem solving, really trying to understand really what is the problem, what can we do to help fix it. It's about 100% of the time it's cash flow to start with, but that's really a symptom of the problem, the larger problem. But the cash flow situation always has to be rectified or stabilized first before we can do just about anything. So we spend a lot of our time on cash flow. I'll give an example of a case that I worked on, and these last couple of years have been different for our industry than any other in the past. Usually in the past, we'd get involved with a company that was in financial distress, and it would have some sort of clear operational problem, or it will have a clear problem with a customer, or raw material prices, or something that was really driving the distress situation that was inherently fixable. In the last couple of years, I can't tell you how many companies I have worked with that have been really great companies, very well run, very sophisticated leadership, and still struggling because of the overall economy. Just a lot of companies that have experienced significant revenue declines as a result of the overall economy. And, you know, in those situations, it almost sometimes it doesn't matter how good you are. If the experiences outside of your control are impacting your business, it may not be your fault. And that adds to the emotion because it may not seem fair. But in the example that I'll give you, I worked with a company that sold industrial paint to auto suppliers and other industrial customers that used my client's paint for application on plastic parts. As I said, the revenue started dropping more for reasons out of their control, economic reasons, and not so much as a result of anything the company had done. They began to lose money, and liquidity was becoming a very big concern. They were running out of cash. It was a family-owned business, and very compassionate to the employees of the organization. They did not want to let anyone go. Even though several customer lines were unprofitable, they did not want to go and ask customers for price increases. They found that very embarrassing. They thought that would be very bad for business in the long run. And in general, they were somewhat paralyzed and embarrassed. They felt, you know, personally responsible for their situation. They wanted to keep it quiet. They wanted to put a, you know, pleasant face on it. They did the same when dealing with their lender, which was try to pretend that everything was okay. And all of that ended up being basically a roadblock for them to really deal with their problems. And especially in this day and age, at least over the last couple of years, I've really encouraged my clients to recognize the situation, take action, do things that are painful for the greater good of the company, to really do what's necessary to survive as a business. And the companies that I've seen that have weathered that successfully have really had to dig down deep and kind of, you know, learn what they're made of. In this situation, after many meetings and conversations, and the conversations grew increasingly more emotional, more personal, we came to the agreement to make some very difficult headcount cuts. I influenced them and really got them to focus on executive level, management level headcount cuts, where the money is. When I work with companies, especially smaller companies, they tend to want to focus on the forklift driver or the AP clerks because they don't know them that well, and it's easier from a personal standpoint. They don't want to let go Joe, the VP of sales, because he's worked there for 25 years and he's a good friend. So I try to take that part of the emotion out of it and really help them decide what's best for the company. We went to several customers and asked for price increases. Many of those customers, surprisingly, immediately understood what my client was asking for, and in fact were surprised that my client had not reached out to them sooner. One or two customers did decide to leave, but again, they were unprofitable customers, so addition by subtraction, not the worst thing in the world. So we did a lot of other things, but we negotiated a temporary payment solution with the lender. All these changes were painful. Over 20 people lost their jobs, but over 150 people saved their jobs by stabilizing the organization, stabilizing the cash flow, working with the lenders. And in the end, my clients were very happy to have the advice that they got. At times, they didn't like me at all. sometimes they would yell at me. I try not to, you know, I try not to, try to understand where they're coming from. I try to be as compassionate as I can be and just try to help them get through it. So that's the example. A lot of those are parallels that we'll see in almost every single case, but each case obviously has many, many nuances.
Yeah, Greg, you mentioned that obviously cash flow is a symptom of some other underlying issue, whether it's operational, customer-based. You talked a lot about how you go in and try to stabilize the cash flow situation, yet my inclination is to think that as a certified turnaround professional, you are experienced and capable of doing a lot more than just simply telling them how to run a cash flow business. So tell us a little bit more about, once you stabilize the cash flow, how do you then go in and fix the real problem that produced the cash flow issue?
Well, in each case, like I said, each case is a problem-solving situation. So there's a several-day due diligence period where we're just trying to, you know, get up to speed as quickly as possible and really learn what's driving it. And that exercise in and of itself usually highlights the main issues. And quite honestly, I don't want to, say the job is easy because it isn't. But quite honestly, the issues are known to management most times. It's not that we're geniuses and we figure out something they don't already know. It's a matter of dragging it out of them because they don't want to deal with it. So we try to figure out what those main issues are and help our client to deal with particularly what those issues are. Most recently, it's been economic issues, revenue issues, but those are the hardest to deal with because the only way you can stay on top of that is to cut your costs, to get your cost structure down to match your revenues, at least until you can get the revenues back up. And those are the most painful cuts because you may be cutting heads, people that haven't done anything wrong. They've done their jobs, and because of the circumstances, may be out of a job.
What are some of the most common mistakes that these owners and managers seem to make in these crisis situations? You mentioned, staying quiet and not talking to their customers and bankers, et cetera, which seems definitely like a huge one. But any other mistakes that you see them making that have contributed to their situation?
Yeah, Betty hit on that earlier. I was glad to hear her say that staying quiet is a problem because I feel so strongly that communicating, it's amazing how much a higher level of communication with all parties involved can really help you. But other than that, the mistakes I see is doing nothing, really being paralyzed, sitting and hoping. And a lot of times I'll try to jostle my client out of the funk that they're in and say, you know, hope is not a strategy. You really have to come up with a plan here. And the worst thing that often happens, and it's usually because of the emotion that's involved, the owner manager will take a very antagonistic attitude towards anybody that's putting pressure on them, which is usually a banker or lender. And that is about 90% of the time the absolute wrong thing to do. Because you need them. You need them really badly to help you get out of the soup that you're in. So taking an adversarial approach with your bank may feel good for 5 minutes, but in the long run, it's not going to be a good solution for you.
Fantastic. You know, I can imagine that in this situation where cash flow is an issue, that there is always a struggle to determine what the right balance is between spending money to help yourself and saving money to hunker down. So what are some of the most common value proposition conversations you can have with a client that says, you know what, I know you're in cash flow problems, but you really do need to spend the money on getting somebody in to help you because it's going to end up helping you in the future.
Mm-hmm.
How do you have that conversation with companies?
Well, it's a very delicate conversation, and it's usually one where at least the first couple times we have the conversation, there's disagreement, and a lot of what I suggest to my clients doesn't seem intuitive at first. Seems very contradictory, paying a consultant to help them through these situations, and the only way I can do it is to try to gain credibility with them and really get them to understand, as Betty said, that I'm just going to give you honest answers, and I really care about the situation, and you're going to choose to believe me and trust me, or you're not. And that's kind of probably the main difference that makes a really good turnaround consultant and one that, you know, one where that's not so successful. They can't gain that trust with their client.
If for the listeners who are out there in a situation where they can't sleep at night, you know, things aren't going as well as they'd like for them to go, and they're wondering, am I in a situation, can I wait it out, do I really need to do something, what would you like to tell the listeners that if they're in this situation or they're experiencing these things, this is not a time to wait, this is a time when you need to take some action because you are in or about to get in a distressed situation?
Yeah, I've been in the mode of trying to give pep talks quite a bit because it really is a tough time. And again, it's in a lot of ways it's not fair. But what I always try to do is just really, you know, if you're laying asleep at night, I know it's easy to say, but it would be nice if people could just turn it off, get a good night's rest, and when they wake up in the morning, really have a higher level of energy to get through the situation. I mean, tough times really determine what people are made of, and I try to get that through to my clients that this is a time where you're gonna shine, truly shine. You think you've done well in the past, but these actions over the next several months will probably be the most important decisions you've ever made in your career. And if you get through this time, if you succeed in a very difficult time, surviving is a competitive advantage. So if you're one of the companies that make it through and several of your competitors don't, then good times will come for you again. But you have to be very focused on survival. Mm-hmm. And don't be embarrassed. Yep. Don't be embarrassed. Everybody's dealing with it.
If they're looking at their books or they're looking at their cash flow situation, or what other triggers do you see that companies should look at and say, red flag, need to do something?
Well, red flag is always your debt level. Debt can be very risky at times, and I've seen so many situations where times are good, we're looking at an acquisition, we really want to buy this company, but we have to borrow a lot to get there. And once you load up on debt, you really take a lot of your cushion away. So once you recognize that your cushion is gone, you have no margin for error. That you're in a distressed situation right there, and you really need to work to get yourself to a more stable situation. So, anytime you get in kind of that red zone, and it could be in good times, I encourage owners, managers to really treat it like it's a distressed situation. If you're thinking that it might be, it is, because it only takes one. I hear the term perfect storm all the time. It drives me crazy because usually it's just a storm. Mm-hmm. It's just a small storm, but you're not prepared for it. And that's what turns you upside down.
Fantastic advice. You know, we had a question from one of our listeners, and it was about a receivables insurance. As you get into companies and you understand and see what's going on, what is your perspective on a receivables insurance plan?
Well, I've seen it a number of times over my career, and I'm sure there's lots of uses for receivables insurance. Where I've seen it most is with specific customers. Vendors are looking for insurance against customers that they know may be in trouble. I heard a lot about it when GM and Chrysler were struggling. They were looking for insurance against those receivables. In those times, I find that you can get insurance, but it can be very, very expensive. Now, I'm sure there's other circumstances where credit insurance is used, but those are the times I tend to see it. And it's usually when you've got a customer that's in distress.
Very good. We're going to go ahead and move on to our next guest, and if we have any extra time at the end, then I'll open up questions for Greg to the other panelists. Now Jonathan Friedman, who is president of Aberdeen Funding, he's from South Africa, is a chartered accountant, which is the U.S.'s version of a CPA, was also a professor of accounting in South Africa, and has been CFO of various small and mid-sized companies both in South Africa and in the U.S. He came to the United States in 1985 and started Aberdeen Funding in 1994 and has been operating that very successfully since then. Jonathan, thank you for your participation in our program.
My pleasure.
To address a little bit of what Greg just left off on the credit insurance, with your business model of funding people's accounts receivables, I imagine that you come into contact with a lot of business brokers like Betty and certified turnaround professionals like Greg, who are looking for ways to relieve cash flow problems and will end up turning to a company like yours. What kinds of things are you seeing in this marketplace with distressed companies looking for alternative forms of funding, given the credit and the banking situation having tightened significantly?
Strangely enough, over the last year or so, when we've subjected ourselves to this economic recession, people would say to me, well, your business, Jonathan, must be booming. To some extent, that's true, but from another perspective, the fact of the matter is that the decline in economic activity has also resulted in a decline for the demand for financing. There's been less need for it, and to some extent, many people have been discouraged by the fact that the banks essentially closed down. To some extent, also, there is... I find some ignorance of the fact that factors actually exist. In many conversations that I've had on many different occasions with many different people in different industries, when I've mentioned factoring, I've received somewhat of a blank look and have had to describe it in fair detail. The concept is quite simple, but as we have seen over the last few months, I think everybody will agree with me, it appears that economic activity is increasing. I've discovered with my clients, and we have a broad range of clients across all industries, so we see activity levels fluctuate from industry to industry, that even, for example, in the construction industry, there appears to be a greater activity. So we did have some clients that over the last year suffered absolutely no change in their sales volume. And to some extent, those clients are involved in industries that simply are above the demands of the consumer or business. I give you a simple example. The agricultural industry in Florida, the oranges grow from the trees, whether or not people are buying them and whether or not the demand for oranges is greater or less. So those orchards have to be serviced, maintained, and nurtured. And as a result, the ancillary industries that support those kind of activities have not seen any fluctuation in their activities.
That's wonderful to know. I actually hadn't thought that there was any industry that was above the economy except for healthcare. People still get sick, but even then, people are still cutting back on their health insurance, and so therefore they're seeking of services. Are you seeing a lot of distressed companies trying to get alternative funding because of cash flow needs?
It's an interesting question, and I could say yes or no, but in my experience over the last 15 or 16 years in the factoring industry, it has become quite apparent to me that as many companies as are in distress are looking for outside funding as are companies that are not in distress. So, yes, a company that is in distress clearly is there because of various reasons. Greg touched upon it briefly. And I'd like to summarize that companies get into distress situations in our situation currently for reasons really beyond their control. They're in a particular market, the market disappears, and it requires a huge amount of agility for management to transform their companies from operating in one way to another. So there is a need for companies in distress situations, and our objective when we are approached by companies such as this is, as Betty indicated, we try and look ahead. Clearly what we do not wish to do is to finance a company that is in distress, that is going to remain so, or whose condition will worsen. We look for companies who, if they are in distress situations, at least we see an ability to change that and emerge from it. Those dictates are dependent on many things. Management, the ability of management to manage and control. and obviously to some extent the exigencies of the market to which they are selling.
What kind of company or in what circumstances is an ideal company for a factoring situation?
Well, I like to say that different factoring companies have different target markets, but from a general perspective, I think that a company that is growing, that is profitable, is definitely for us a prime candidate for financing. And that actually brings me to the point that Greg made in relation to credit insurance or credit guarantee insurance, as some people call it. To some extent, credit insurance, particularly from our perspective, is a tool that factors will use for their clients when the factor's assessment and tolerance of risk is perhaps different than the proclivities of their clients wishing to sell to a particular customer. In some cases, our ability to assess the creditworthiness of customers is made difficult by a simple lack of information. In other instances, where even though we have some information, we may assess a credit limit of X, and that is insufficient for the business volume that has to be supported. In those cases, we will go to the credit guarantee insurance companies, and we will often find that their attitude towards risk, for whatever reason, may be greater than ours, and will be able to insure us against a higher volume of activity than we would necessarily be comfortable with. So it's not necessarily always companies that are in distress or companies with weak credit that one is selling to. It sometimes also is simply a factor that information is hard to come by and that the factor's attitude towards risk may be different, and clearly that's an individual choice.
Wonderful. Is there a situation in which you would recommend or that you would say a business should not go into a factoring arrangement?
I like to draw the analogy of putting a screw into a piece of wood. You could very well achieve it with a hammer, but really the correct tool would be a screwdriver. Both methods will succeed, but the one will leave an awful mess. So factoring is a financial tool. And is used under circumstances where it's appropriate. Which circumstances are appropriate? Well, if you're able to if you're able to borrow money from the bank sufficient to meet your needs, then clearly the cost of capital from a bank is going to be substantially less than the alternatives that are available, including factoring. So in addition to which, when clients do approach me, potential clients do approach me, one of the things that I look at is their ability to absorb the cost of factoring. I look at their margins. If they're operating at very small margins, the cost of factoring can be prohibitively difficult to absorb unless those customers, those clients have the ability to pass on some of their charges by increased selling prices to their customers. So in the current circumstances where banks are really shutting down and require amounts of collateral that most private companies don't have, where a private company or closely held company is attempting to grow, banks really are not keen to finance those types of activities, are not keen to finance companies whose cash flow in the past does not reflect a future ability to repay increased debt. So under those circumstances, factoring is a very viable alternative. And the essential difference between our provision of finance and the more traditional lending institutions is that our security, our evaluation of risk, is focused not on the client's ability to repay, but on the ability of their customers to repay. So you might have a very small company with very few resources, an inability to provide great amounts of capital, but who provides a service or sells goods to large, well-known, creditworthy customers. In those cases, our risk is much lower than it would appear to the bank who is approached to provide financing to that customer.
And that's a very good point, Jonathan. Are there any industries or even regions of the world in which your clients' customers are, whether industry or geographic region, that make it more difficult to factor?
There are. There are some industries that do not lend themselves very easily to the ability of a factoring company to finance. Regrettably, even though there is great activity, as Betty mentioned earlier, and there doesn't seem to be any drop in activity at all, is the healthcare industry. financing healthcare receivables requires a level of expertise because of the complexity involved that most factoring companies do not have. If a doctor, for example, presents you with an invoice for services rendered, or a hospital does, you have to be really specialized to know how much of that invoice is really going to be paid finally by the health insurance company. So that requires a complete level of knowledge and skill that very few factoring companies have. As a result, there are a few companies in the United States who finance those industries specifically and solely and have generated an expertise. The construction industry, too, unfortunately, is a bugbear for factors based purely, and there are many reasons, but the essential reason is that in most instances in the construction industry, we're dealing with invoices that are for progress billings that represent no necessary absolute liability on the part of the customer to pay. There are exigencies involved in the way that activity takes place in a construction environment, whereby, for example, if the contractor submits an invoice for the activity for the past week and for some reason is unable to continue or is not able to perform at a level required by the architect, the property owner, then the possibility always exists that those property owners or architects will deny liability for an invoice for activity that has been performed, even though at the time that the invoice was generated, such liability was accepted. So, again, there are companies that specialize in these industries, but by and large, the factoring industry does not. The clear and absolute requirement for any factoring operation is that an invoice needs to represent an absolute liability on the part of the person being invoiced to pay, and that that person has the ability to make payment in due course.
For those companies who do business internationally, are there particular regions of the world, whether it's Eastern Europe or Southeast Asia or wherever, that the factoring companies tend to shy away from and say, you know, it may even be a good customer, maybe a big customer, but we're just not comfortable with that region of the world?
Absolutely. The ultimate risk and the exit strategy that the factor needs to look at is what happens if the customer refuses to pay for whatever reason. Is there access to an effective and easily understood legal system? Is the legal system above reproach? Is there a level of corruption? Is it easy to find legal assistance in those countries? So, you know, I don't wish to name countries, but clearly we can identify those countries that have legal systems that are on a par with us, that subscribe to the same values that we do. Those countries internationally are countries that might lend themselves to being, if they are customers in those countries, to being factored. Again, there are many factoring companies that simply are not interested in dealing with anything other than domestic issues.
So in terms of determining the fee for a factoring situation, is it primarily based on the credit risk and the credit availability of the client's customers, or are there other factors that you look at in determining your fee?
Strangely enough, an overall assessment of the general body of customers that a client deals with may have an insignificant and minuscule impact on the level of fees. What determines the level of fees in a factoring environment is, A, the volume. Clearly, that's a characteristic that determines costs in many different circumstances. In addition to which, what is the administrative burden to the factor to take on a particular client? Clearly, again, if you were to give me 10 invoices for $10,000 each, as opposed to smaller invoices, the larger invoices carry less of an administrative burden, and as a result, represent a higher level of profitability once that credit risk is controlled. So fees are determined by volume, by invoice size, and to some extent by industry.
Great. You know, a lot of companies that are in distressed situations are often defined as in or about to get into bankruptcy and in very significant credit risk problems. With the factoring situation, how do you believe that use of a factoring company impacts a company's credit or status in the marketplace?
I'm not sure if anybody around this panel has ever heard the expression booming into bankruptcy. That was an expression that my accounting professor, may he rest in peace, drummed into my mind on many an occasion, amongst other things. And the fact of the matter is that... I'm sorry, can you repeat your question? I had a momentary block.
Sure. It's whether use of a factoring company impacts a client's credit worthiness or status in the marketplace. How does it impact a company to use your services?
The clear and simple answer, and I guess I am prejudiced, but I've never seen any negative impact, is that if a company is concerned about using a factor, that situation will have an impact on its reputation. There are a number of points that I can raise that dispel those issues. The first thing is, and I think everybody will agree with me, that ultimately the relationship between a provider of goods or services and its clients is determined not by whom the customer ends up having to cut a check to, but whether such goods or services are being provided at a price that is acceptable, at a level of service that is acceptable to its customers. The other thing is, and this may be a somewhat strange example, I often say to my clients, if you look at some of the larger big box stores around, if you have an account with them and you look at the fine print at the bottom of the page when you receive your monthly statement, you'll often find that even though you're dealing with big box store ABC, that in small letters at the bottom you will notice that there is a notation on the statement indicating that Citibank or some other large organization is actually the owner of the receivable. So, borrowing money from outside sources to finance your business is not something that is a disgrace. And the one example that seems to be very simple and very easy to absorb, I say to somebody, when you go in to buy an automobile and you have to borrow money to pay for it, does that make you feel as if you're a person of low integrity, or do you feel comfortable that the GMAC or the other lending company is happy to lend you money? So, some people can deal with the perception that somehow factoring is the last, like patriotism, the last choice of the damned, but it's not. It's a good financial tool, and as I said earlier, whether you use it or not really depends on whether or not it's going to help your company grow and prosper.
Fantastic. We are going to run a little bit over our 11 o'clock hour, which is all right. So we want to give enough time for Jonathan and then go back to Greg for both a description of your company, of what you do, and what kinds of clients you serve and what you're looking for. So, Jonathan, why don't you tell us a little bit about your company, your client base, and what kind of business you're looking for, and then we can open it up to questions.
Aberdeen Funding serves clients across the United States, although because of its geographic location, primarily in the Southeast. We look for clients whose volume will be anywhere from a startup in rare cases, but we do attend to startups up to a maximum of $10 million in sales revenue. We deal with companies across all industries, and in fact, it is our desire to have as diverse a range of industries in our portfolio as possible, because clearly, that shields us from the risks of that may be endemic to particular industries. Our really good clients tend to have a broad range of customers themselves, and so we look for a diversity of their customer base as well. Although if a client is heavily concentrated in one or two really good customers, we find that acceptable. So I hope that describes our target.
Okay, very good. I'd like to open it up now to questions for Jonathan. Do Lee or Betty or Greg have any questions for Jonathan?
I actually have one, Don, but you asked it and he answered it very well, because I had actually heard it factors at one time referred to as lenders of last resort. But given that banks are closing their doors and others are backing off from funding, how could it be a negative connotation these days? Everybody's sort of forced into alternative financing arenas.
Well, the fact of the matter is that I financed companies who, without my financing, would have gone under, mm-hmm. and who, with my financing, have grown exponentially. So if you think about it carefully, why should there be a negative connotation? it's an old hackneyed perception that is based on prejudice to some extent and really does not reflect on your company's ability to provide goods or services in the marketplace.
Does your typical client stay with you for a period of time, then go and get conventional financing, or once they kind of build this relationship, they stay with you for a while?
Lee, I would like to tell you that we never lose a client, but I would be lying. In fact, the only way in which I feel happy about losing a client is when I am able to allow the company, through using factoring, to strengthen its balance sheet, to become more mature, to develop the collateral, the skills, the profit history, the cash flow, to be able to go to a bank. So in many circumstances, however, particularly smaller companies, they see us as an extension of the company themselves. Our function as handling their receivables, they essentially outsource their receivables function to us, apart from the generation of invoices, which they continue to do. We monitor their receivables, we send out statements, we assess credit for them. And so many companies eventually see us simply as their receivables division, build the cost of our capital into their selling prices, and stay with us for many years. If you want to know an average length of relationship, I would say 2 years is probably a low ball figure. I have clients that have been with me for 8 or 10 years, and they just stay with me, and they've grown. And for them, it's just a convenience at this point in time. The relationship is simple. They understand it. They don't have to implement it. They don't have to implement anything new. They don't have to hire new staff to handle the responsibilities that we do.
Can clients pick and choose which receivables they want you to finance, or is it an all-or-nothing situation?
In some circumstances, clients can pick or choose receivables that they wish us to factor. They cannot change their mind about it once they've started, though, because part of the standard operating procedure is that a notification of assignment is sent to customers, advising them that the invoices that they will receive or that they have now received from our customer or from our client has been assigned to us, and that payment in the future needs to come to us to settle those liabilities. And so simply from a logistical perspective, from maintaining good relationships with customers, it would be very confusing if they were instructed to send payment on invoices number 1 through 10 to us, and 11 to 15 to somebody else, and 16 to us, and so it would become completely chaotic. So simply from a practical perspective, once a client has selected an account, a customer to be factored, that relationship should be maintained.
Very good. Any other questions for Jonathan? No? Okay, Jonathan, how can we reach your company?
Well, we have a website, aberdeenfunding.com. Or my telephone number is 404-303-1545. But I always send people to the website. It somehow seems to be easier these days. aberdeenfunding.com.
Very good. And all of our guests' information will also appear on our website for corporate conversations here at Atlanta Business Radio as well. Now I'd like to go back to Greg, since we bypassed him a little earlier. We were concerned about timing. I'd like to open up the floor to, Greg, let's hear a little bit more about your company and the full scope of services that you offer and your expertise.
Thanks, Don. Yeah, we are a 60-professional firm, so we're a national firm, but not a big firm. We primarily provide turnaround consulting services to middle-market companies, and we think a middle market is $25 million of revenue to $250 million of revenue, thereabouts. We also provide capital raise services. We will go out and try to help clients refinance and maybe find a factor or find an equity partner, that sort of thing. We have a litigation support group that will provide expert witness testimony on either bankruptcy cases or economic damages type situations. All of that's all tied into the same core set of skills, which are financial analytical skills and problem solving, essentially.
Wonderful. Does anybody have any questions for Greg with his turnaround and other professional consulting services?
Betty does. How many companies do you see that you have to tell them, or do you, that you're not capable of being turned around, that it goes right to liquidation. And what type of conversation is that?
Well, recently that's happened a fair number of times, I won't lie to you, but I would say, you know, it depends on the circumstances and the timing. I would say most companies we can work with to get stabilized, so it's certainly over 50%, maybe as high in certain times as 70, 80%. The conversation is always different. The one example I can think of is working with a 75-year-old trucking company, unionized company that was competing with non-unionized carriers, family-owned, and the owner, the son of the founder, wanted to dip into his 401k fund to keep the company going, and had a real long, honest conversation about why that might not be a good idea for him, given the circumstances of the company. And it was real difficult for him because he had several of his children working at the company, and you know, felt responsible, even though they were fully capable of landing another job. He wanted to do everything he could to keep the company going, including bet his retirement on it. So, in that circumstance, we just had a long conversation, and I think he came to the conclusion that it probably wasn't worth the risk to do that. Other circumstances, I see owner managers want to spend every last dime to keep it going, and it becomes more of a personal conversation than professional at that point.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
This is Jonathan. I have a quick question for you. Ultimately, whether a company survives or not is a relationship between sales, costs, and being able to provide cash management. In a lot of instances, though, a company to survive has to change the way it does business. How amenable do you find people? We mentioned earlier that they have to spend money on things that they haven't spent money. For example, they've been coasting along. Now they need to get their marketing ramped up. Are you able to persuade somebody who has never done any marketing to say, look, your salvation lies in being able to market your company better? Are they amenable to those kind of changes?
Well, it's extremely difficult to get somebody to change their management style. But when we help our clients understand their weaknesses, sometimes we get them to let go. Maybe let somebody else run the company. That's a tough conversation. I've had it a number of times. Once they get in the habit of accepting advice, once they get over that hump, a lot of times can make all the difference in the world.
Opens the floodgate.
And sometimes we just don't get there. I mean, I'll be honest. Sometimes, people can be very stubborn, just can't change. And that's usually when we don't have success, when that happens.
Now, when you're working with these companies that are in distress and they, like you had mentioned, like you're going to tell them that guy that's been sitting next to you for 25 years has got to go in order to make this company viable again. Do you just whisper that in the CEO's ear and he does that? Or does your firm take that responsibility and become kind of the heavy in this case?
Well, I whisper it in his ear first, and then if he agrees, usually I will be the heavy. I'll be the bad guy. That's always
that's
easier.
That's part of your responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. I'm happy. I mean, I feel that that's the best way to do it. It takes some of the emotion out of it,
right.
And I can do it more easily than the CEO who's has to let his friend go.
Now, has there ever been a situation where you had to recommend that the person who engaged with you had to go?
Yes. I don't know if we have enough time for this story, but it's a good one. I worked with a CEO of a small company. We went through the whole organizational chart to figure out, where we could cut some costs. And we got down to the very end. And again, I'm working with the CEO. There was also a chairman of this company who's actually the owner. So it's a fairly small company, $25 million company, and I said to the CEO, I am not used to a company having a CEO and a chairman when it's a $25 million company, and I really think that one of you needs to go in order for this company to survive. It can't. This company can't support two big salaries like that. And the reaction I got was agitated at first, but then the CEO came back to me and said, "You know, I remember I thought about what you said, and I think I need to go." And that wasn't the reaction I was expecting. He said, "I think the chairman could come back. He used to run the company. He could come back. It's his company. He could really drive some change here, and we could save, you know, whatever the salary was, $300,000 or something like that." And I said, "That's the most selfless thing I've ever heard." And we got the chairman on the phone and told him, you know, what we recommended. And he got more angry, and he said that was the stupidest thing he ever heard, and there was no way he was going to let the CEO resign. But 24 hours later, after he thought about it, he called us both up and said that's the right thing to do for the company, and the CEO resigned and moved on. It was really sad. I really felt I wasn't expecting it to go that way, but it was the right answer. It was the right answer for the company, and the owner got reengaged in his business and really did what needed to be done, and the CEO moved on to hopefully greener pastures and worked out. So that was very tense, very emotional.
Nice success story. Any other questions for anybody else on the panel? Nope. Well, great. Well, it sounds like what we've learned today is that obviously there is a little bit of cash is king mentality that, you know, you can't function without cash flow, but yet there are a lot of other symptoms that have gotten you there, and some of the biggest signs of success or failure are going to be an emotional attachment, a quietness, not talking to your customers, not talking to your bankers, getting engaged, being obstinate and not seeing what's being put out in front of you and being willing to make those hard choices. And it's interesting that we've all heard from all of you about different scenarios that have resulted in a cash flow crunch, either poor management and not enough attention to having reserves to, you know, save for that rainy day that's not if but when it happens, as well as, you know, real growth of companies that are, good companies with good management but just simply in growth mode that because of the economy have just had a problem funding their growth. So there are different ways that we've talked about that can help that funding, whether it's, you know, some kind of cost cutting or reorganization or alternative funding that can make a company successful. And it sounds like it's pretty important, though, that business owners out there take a good hard look at their balance sheet and identify whether or not they are one of these red flag in distress or about to get into distressed companies and do something if their balance sheet shows a zero at the end in terms of remaining cash after liabilities. So I hope that the listeners have enjoyed this show. I think it's been very informative. And I'd like to thank each of my guests, Greg Charleston, CPA, Senior Managing Director of Conway McKenzie and Certified Turnaround Professional. And by the way, Greg, how can we reach you and your company?
ConwayMcKenzie.com or 770-394-9905.
Fantastic. And Betty Reed, CPA and Certified Management Accountant and Principal at Abraxas Business Services. And again, that contact information is?
Abraxas.biz, and it's 770-689-7704.
Great. And Jonathan Friedberg, President of Aberdeen Funding, and that contact information again is?
AberdeenFunding.com, 404-303-1545.
Fantastic. Well, I want to thank our listeners for joining us on Corporate Conversations this week. My name is Dawn Ely and our producer, Lee Cantor. And next week's show is going to be on the software-based telecom companies in the marketplace, what their current experiences are in that space, their challenges, and what the status of that marketplace is. So I hope that you will join us next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Thank you very much.